For me, would you help me welcome Jerry J. from Dallas, Texas?
Is this really, it's not working, is it?
This works.
That does it. All right. If I can hold it up for an hour, I guess I can do it if y'all can stand up in the back. My name's Jerry Jones, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and because this program works, I've been sober since January the 1st of 1973, for which I'm very grateful. I'm also very grateful to be asked to come to your country and to share with you. It's really a privilege and an honor to be with you and to have an opportunity to tell you something about myself. I've been very well treated since I've been here. Ernie called me regularly trying to find out when I was coming, and Hal got me at the airport, and everything's been good, just really good, since I've arrived. I've met a lot of you, and I've enjoyed it very much. Special weekend for me. This is my Al-Anon and my 35th wedding anniversary. I had to bring her this time because I didn't want you to think I hit her. And believe me, I am smart enough not to hit an Al-Anon. I'm not only an alcoholic, but I am the adult spouse of an Al-Anon. I have suffered from Al-Anon brutality. When I was drinking, one night I was alone while she had gone to one of those meetings. Along with my dog. And as I sat there in the solitude of my den with my bottle, thinking about my life and those who had harmed me, a great truth came to me, and when my wife came in, I said, I have just come upon a great truth. And the truth is, there's only one thing in the world that loves me, and that is this dog. And I said, it's not fair. It is not right or fair, because everyone should have at least two things or people to love. A tear began to trickle slowly down my cheek. And she looked at me with those steely blue Al-Anon eyes. She said, I'm going to talk to my sponsor. And she went to the phone and called her sponsor, and she came back in just a few minutes and said, my sponsor says you're right. We're going to get you another dog. She hasn't softened a lot in the intervening years. Just recently, I was talking to her, and I said, Billy, I've had a fair amount of success in life and made some money, and we're pretty comfortable. But I wondered, would you love me if I didn't have any money and if I were drunk? And she looked at me, and she said, Jerry, certainly I would love you. I would miss you, but I would love you. You'll see in a little while as we talk, she really was an instrument of the power that we seek that really saved me. I think very highly of Al-Anon. I didn't like to hear Al-Anon speakers when I got here because I like to think that I hadn't hurt anyone but myself. But I had. And that was a part of the disease of alcoholism. And I had to come to grips. I told you about two things I am, being the spouse of an Al-Anon and an alcoholic, and I'm also a lawyer. I'm a Texan. I'm from a different country than you. And as I go along and tell you things about me, then I began to, with, if I'm not careful, to withdraw, to get further and further away from you. We become different the more things I give you. Now, there might be a few people that could say, well, I'm a lawyer too, or I come from Texas, or I'm an American, or United States of American citizen. I could say some of those things, and you might identify with some of those. I could say I'm a man. Many of you could identify with that. But we have a tendency to compartmentalize ourselves, and the more we compartmentalize ourselves, the more we become isolated and lonely. And that's what I was when I got here. I think loneliness is probably one of the most common symptoms of the alcoholic, and probably that's true of the Al-Anon as well. Nobody knows. Nobody knows. We don't think anybody knows. And Alcoholics Anonymous does away with that. When I tell you I'm an alcoholic, we can right away begin to identify. Whether you're Al-Anon, Alateen, or alcoholic, we've all shared the experience of a common disease. We've all been there together. Our book says that we not only share a common problem, but we share a common solution. And I'm going to have to talk about the problem so we can communicate well enough to talk about the solution. The solution is a power. Lack of power was our dilemma. The solution is the way we make contact with that power, the way we enlist the aid of a power greater than ourselves. Our book tells us that in this search, we are all equal. It says that if what we learn and feel and know means anything at all, it is that we are all children of a living Creator, no matter what our race, color, or creed, and that each of us can form a relationship with that Creator if we have the willingness and the honesty enough to try. And what I'd like to do, it says we can form that relationship on simple and understandable terms if we try that way. So in as simple a way as I can, I would like to share with you my search for that power and my success or lack of success in that endeavor. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew absolutely nothing about alcoholism. I supposed if you had asked me to define an alcoholic, I would have given you some kind of picture of some guy standing in a soup line somewhere in an overcoat, carrying a brown bag, that kind of a person. That's what I guess I really, really thought. I've heard people described as alcoholics, but they were people that didn't seem to be much like me. And so I had resistance to the word alcoholism. I didn't want to say. When I first went to the meetings where we went around in circles and said our name and said I'm an alcoholic, gosh, it stuck right in my throat. I had a terrible time spitting that word out. I did not want to be an alcoholic. I didn't know what it was. I didn't believe it was a disease. That was a cop-out the way I saw it. Until later on, I came to understand a little bit about the fact that alcoholism is a disease. Alcoholism is a disease because it has certain common symptoms among its sufferers. We all react to this disease in certain ways. For example, it has a physical side. It has a physical side that when I take a drink as an alcoholic, something happens to me. Something in my body, a biochemical reaction or something, sends a signal to my brain, and the signal it always sends to my brain is, my, that was good. I think we'll have another one of those. And we have another one of those and another one of those until we've had too many of those. Now, it's got another part of it, and that's mental, basically. It's called the obsession. An obsession is a big thought. So big, it pushes all the other thoughts you might have out of your mind. And it is, for me, a drink would make it better. I don't care what it is. A drink would make it better. It could be a wedding, it could be a funeral, it could be whatever, you know. Happy day, good day, bad day, whatever. Just a drink would make it better. And that got very deep-seated in my mind. I found alcohol was my solution to life. The solution to alcoholism seems to be not to drink. Lots of people led me to believe that I would be a better man, lawyer, family man, whatever, if I just didn't drink as much as I drank. So it seemed to me that what I needed to do was learn how to control my drinking. And I tried to control my drinking style. I didn't have much luck, but I tried. Never occurred to me, I didn't really understand the underlying problem of this. Alcoholics Anonymous has got another interesting sidelight. You hear people talk from this podium all the time, and they think of all sorts of things in their past that help them remember and illustrate the truths of this program. And I learned about alcoholism one night when I was sitting in a meeting listening to somebody talk, and I remembered my dog. I was raised out in West Texas on a farm, and we had a dog. My dog's name was Patches. He was mostly an English bulldog. He was a hell of a dog. He was good with kids. He was a good watchdog. He was brave. He was courageous. He was a good fighter. A couple of weeks before this story happened, he found a badger up in the field. And the badger weighed 1 pound more than he did. We know that because after 2 hours of fighting, Patches finally killed him. And we weighed them both. Just to give you a little insight into Patches' character, every day for a week after he'd killed that old badger, he'd go up in the field and find the carcass and pick it up and just shake hell out of it. Just in case he happened to have come back. On this day, you know, he was a hero. He whipped a badger. He was laying around the house. No problems. He had no problems. He was well fed. He was well loved. His ears had been scratched that morning. Everything was good about life. And into our yard came a boar hog, a big, ugly boar hog. He got out of a neighbor's pen and came down to our house, and he had those long yellow tusks sticking up, you know, from his jaw. And Patches made a decision to go out and get hold of the hog. Now, bulldogs don't make casual decisions. He went out and he got hold of the hog, and when he gets hold of the hogs, they hang on to hogs. And it created a problem in our barnyard. The dog was barking, the hog was squealing. My dad came running out of the barn to see what was going on, and he right away got in the middle of both of them. He was kicking hogs and dogs and cussing and trying to get this thing broken up. I saw my dog in a lot of trouble. I saw those tusks. I got out there and was trying to keep my dad from kicking the dog and keep the hog off the dog. My mother saw her kid running into the middle of this fray out there, and she came charging out of the house. And it was chaos. It was absolute chaos. Everybody there knew there was a problem, and we all knew the solution to the problem. Patches turned loose of that hog. Turn him loose. But he didn't turn him loose, but he came off. And as he came off, that old hog wheeled around and cut his throat. And we caught him and shut him down, held him, stopped him, cooled him off, gave him first aid, thought we had solved the problem. We turned him loose. He went right back and got hold of that hog again. Same deal. God, there was squeals and barks and growls and cussing and kicking, and me was out there trying to get in the middle of that deal, and my mother was out there wringing her hands trying to get me out of the fight, and it was chaos. And once again, everyone knew the solution to the problem. Hog knew it. We knew it. Everybody knew it. Patches, turn loose the damn hog. Turn him loose. Well, he came off again. This time we recognized. We recognized that Patches was not himself. I think, Bob, the professionals would say that his emotional nature was on top of his intellect. And it was obvious that we were going to have to commit Patches for a little while. And we committed him by tying him up to the water hydrant. And we isolated him from the problem. We sent the hog away. And I guess I was his counselor. And for a couple of hours, I sat there with Patches, and we thought about his life. We inventoried things like, you know, did you ever have a good day when you're getting hold of hogs? Anyone in your family enjoy it when you're getting hold of hogs? Are you successful as a hog catcher? Do they taste good? You know, all this rest. And in 2 hours, no more than 2 hours, it was pretty obvious that I've got to do something about that string there. A couple hours, it was pretty evident that he was well. And the way you could tell it was because his attitude had changed. He had that little smile dogs get on their face. You know, his tongue was lolling out a little bit, and his little stub of a tail was wagging back and forth, and it was obvious he was okay. So I went and talked to the warden, who was my father, and I said, "Hatcher's as well." He came and looked, and he said, "I think you're right." So we turned him loose. He had to go 2 miles to find the hog this time. Now, can you identify with that story? I was one of the first hogonauts in West Texas, I'll tell you that. But later on, I could identify with the dog, you know. And it seemed like getting hold of the hog was the problem. But you see, it wasn't. It wasn't. The bigger problem was, why did he go the first time, and what sent him back? Turned out it wasn't hogs at all. A couple weeks later, he just made the same decision about a cattle truck, and that's the end of that. Just one shot at that. But you see, that's what alcoholism is like. The secret is to not take the first drink. But even the greater secret is to stay stopped, to find the underlying causes and conditions of our failure, to change the way we think. And as we change the way we think, as we make this kind of a change, it's brought about not by our own power, and not by the power of any living human being. It's brought about by a power greater than ourselves. Something you and I cannot see directly, but we can experience it. We can see the effect of the power. It exists in this room. It is present whenever Alcoholics Anonymous is being practiced the way it's described in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's to that end that we devote our search. First thing you got to do in this search is decide whether you have to have a failure. Anybody in here that hasn't had a failure? We've had some colossal failures in this room, I'll tell you. We've messed it up about as good as you can mess it up. And that seems to be necessary at some level, because when we've messed it up, we're open-minded just for a little while. When we've run out of excuses and run out of people to blame and that sort of thing, finally we sometimes open up and say, maybe I ought to try something else. Maybe something else ought to work. And if we're really lucky, we'll have an opportunity to meet someone in Alcoholics Anonymous who can describe this program for us and get us on the way. It took me a long time to recognize I was powerless over alcohol. I liked alcohol. I thought I was drinking what I wanted to drink. I wondered sometimes why I wanted to drink as much as I drank, but it seemed like I was doing what I wanted to do. And I didn't mind being a heavy drinker. I kind of liked it. I was kind of a lover and a fighter and a wild horse rider. You know, I didn't want to be too sweet and nice. I was a trial lawyer. Hell, I didn't care whether you liked what I did or not much. Just vote the right way when the judge gave you the charge. That's all there was to like, the way I saw it. And heavy drinkers were common among trial lawyers. And it had been that way from the time I started. I remember when I first went to college, I hadn't had anything to drink. Oh, maybe a beer or something like that. Kind of got up inside my nose, didn't care much about it. I was an athlete. But the world got bigger and more complicated for me when I went to college. Came from a little old bitty town. And I was trying to play athletics in college, and gosh, I never saw guys as big as they had in college. They were just monsters. I used to think I was a basketball player, and I thought if I could ever quit playing guard and get to playing forward, where I'd get down there in that bucket, I mean, I'd show them how to put some points on the board, by God. And I started out trying to do that in college, and I never saw such guys. I mean, I quit shooting quick shots altogether because they'd stuff the ball down my throat every time I left the floor. Couldn't wait to get back out to guard. And you know, the world was complicated. They wore different kind of clothes than I wore. They ate different kind of food. They were smarter than I was. And then one night I was invited to a fraternity party, and they had beer. And they had guys who liked to drink beer. They had guys who didn't give a damn about anything. I was had always felt so responsible. They were totally irresponsible. And I started kind of perking up. This had a little bit of attraction to me. And I was attracted into drinking. And it wasn't very long till I just could get plumb excited about the prospect of getting drunk a week from now. Next Friday night, we are going to get drunk. We're going to save our money, get somebody to go to the liquor store for us, and buy us a carload of booze. It will be all kinds of booze, some we've never even tasted before. And we're going to get in that car and start drinking that booze, and there is absolutely no telling where we'll wind up the next morning or what we will have done the night before. And I just, oh boy, oh boy, I can't hardly wait. And I did it over and over again, and I liked it. I liked the places we drank. I liked the things we did most of the time. I liked getting up the next morning and sitting around and saying, what did we do? Where were we? Do you remember? No, but I remember this, and we'd gradually get the damn story pieced together. We'd think, God, this is great. Let's do it again. What do you think, huh? And I wasn't going to give that up, man. I liked that. That took all the load off my shoulders. I could let the responsibility and the feelings that I had about life just slide off when I got to drinking. And it became my solution. When life got a little too tough, when the feelings, good or bad, got a little too strong, I just got a bottle. And I lived my life that way. My wife, God love her, I tried to get her to be a drinker. Marge, I couldn't get her to go. She'd take that first drink. She didn't go to Montreal on the first drink. She just got sick and wouldn't drink anymore. She was a complete wet blanket. I won't tell you. I just did something, started running with a bunch of people one time. They had a bunch of good-looking wives, and most of them were stewardesses, and Billy had got us out of that group almost before I got us in. I couldn't understand what was wrong. But she didn't like me staying out late drinking. She didn't like me raising hell. And I was responsible. And I loved my kids. So basically what I did is I gave that kind of life up very early. And I became a medicinal drinker. A solitary drinker. If I couldn't go out and drink, I could, by God, drink at home. And I could drink what I wanted and when I wanted to drink it, and it was not open to debate. It's my bottle and my body. And I'm going to mix those two up any way I want to. And we had a lot of arguments about this, but that was my basic posture. And I began to drink. And you see, I didn't think I was powerless over alcohol. Never even occurred to me that I was powerless over alcohol. And I went through law school and early practice of law and all the things that come along with having families and buying houses and doing all this kind of stuff. And I was doing okay. I kept getting a little better jobs and making a little more money and buying a little nicer house and having a little more. I was always out looking for more. I was never satisfied. I had a hole in me that you couldn't fill. I tried to fill it with everything. I tried to fill it with money, and I made more money as I went along. I tried to fill it with position, and I got to be a senior partner in the largest law firm in Dallas. I tried to fill it with wives and kids and that kind of stuff, and I was a little league coach, and I had two nice kids and a lovely wife, and didn't see anyone who had anything that I wanted any better than mine. I was happy with that. I recognized somewhere along the line that I couldn't fill the hole making money and doing that sort of thing, and I went out and began to try to do something like charity work. I spent a couple of years down in the ghetto in Dallas, drinking Ripple wine with the brothers, and learning to do all them handshakes, you know, and we didn't do high fives then, but we did everything else, you know, this kind of stuff. And they ultimately asked me to go back to my home and stay there because I was messing up their lives. And I resented the hell out of it. I took up art. I decided I'd become, maybe it was, all great artists are misunderstood, it seemed to me like. Van Gogh cuts off his ear. I thought about cutting off my ear, but I decided I'd just try something a little simpler first. So I took up, you know, painting and welding and sculpting with a welding torch, and had a little problem there because it's hard to remember when you're drunk what's the hot piece of that. So, that's really difficult. But I solved that problem. What you do is you get a large glass and you fill it with ice cubes and pour whiskey all over the top of it, all the way to the top. And then you start welding. When you pick up the wrong piece of metal, you can tell you have this really acute sense of pain in your hand. Much like this. And I reach down and grab that glass full of ice and I pick up all the ice I can hold in it and just hold it in my hand for a minute and then I drink the whiskey. No problem. Put it all back together, pour some whiskey on it, fire up again, and that's the way I welded. I don't know why I didn't burn down the house or everybody else, but that's what I tried. Ultimately, nothing was working, so I just quit doing anything. I just went to work and worked as long as I could or until I got through and came home. I didn't drink at work because I didn't want anybody to know I was a drunk. I came home and drank what I wanted to drink. And by this time, I was drinking about a quart a day. My day consisted of coming home from work, and I'd drink a half a quart of Beefeater's gin when I got home. That was called martini time. Then I would eat a little mashed potatoes or whatever it was Billy had been trying to get me to eat for about an hour. And then I would drink brandy with a little splash of soda the rest of the evening until somebody put me to bed or whatever. And that was my life. And I was willing to settle for that. I just didn't want to lose any more than I had lost. Yeah, there would have been some clients that had fired me. Yeah, some of my partners weren't sending me work anymore. Yeah, I was having some adversity in my life. It wasn't good, but it was as good as I could get. It wasn't going to get any better. I tried everything I knew to try. Everything I saw you do, you being the world at large, that was supposed to make people happy, I had tried. And it didn't work for me. It didn't work for me. And so I recognized that I was just one of those people who was never going to get it, and I was just going to have to scratch it out until whatever happened, happened. And I was just living it out. Only you can't quit. You can't settle. It always gets worse and worse and worse. And every day you die a little more, and every day you sink deeper into that depression and that dark hole that's called alcoholism. And that's what happened to me. I just kept sinking deeper and deeper. And I kept having more and more trouble. And one of the biggest problems that I had, let me tell you, the biggest problem I had right there in that red blouse, this girl wouldn't give it up. She sent off her papers for me to take tests. She was always doing something. She was always stirring it around. I couldn't get her to leave alone. One night, I asked my daughter where her mother was. And she said, "I don't know, Daddy. She's gone to some kind of a family meeting." And I said, "That doesn't sound very good to me. Tell me what that meeting is." And she didn't know. See, we had decided by that time that we were going to try it for 6 more months and then we're cashing it in. We tried everything. The marriage, nobody's happy there. We just go check it in. But if she's out talking about family meetings, I better have a representative present the way I saw it. So when she came home, I cross-examined her. 30 years I've been a trial lawyer. I've run across some real doozies to cross-examine. But I ain't never got anybody that can touch the lady in the red dress right now. She can duck questions better than any human being I ever saw. "Where have you been?" "Out." "What have you been doing?" "Oh, visiting with friends." "Who are they?" "You wouldn't know." "What were you talking about?" "Oh, we're just sharing our experience, strength, and hope." And it began to go. You know, I just kept closing doors and trying to nail her down. It was like trying to stab a snake with an ice pick. You know, I just couldn't get it narrowed down. Finally, I got a word out of her. The word was Al-Anon. Al-Anon. What would be an Al-Anon? As near as I could figure, it had to be some kind of an aluminum kitchen utensil. But it wasn't. It was a lot worse than that. I thought maybe she'd got a job and gone to work or something. Hell, I've been trying to get that to happen for years. But no, it wasn't that. It was a group of people that anyone
anyone was welcome to go to their meetings if you had a friend or family member who had a problem with alcohol. I'll tell you what, it didn't take me but a minute to know that I was the only candidate for the person with the alcohol problem in her life. And she was going to public meetings discussing my problem. And this ain't something that any trial lawyer really wants to have happen. Many of you have needed, sought the assistance of attorneys. I assume you have yellow pages in Canada where you have listings of attorneys. Did you ever notice anybody say in there, alcoholic attorneys? They don't list that way because nobody wants one. Not even drunks want alcoholic attorneys. Here I am trying to hold my damn life together, trying to preserve what I can of what we've had, and she's going out to public meetings to talk to people about my problem. Well, I know it's just a question of time until a judge or a judge's wife or some lawyer or one of my partners or his wife or a juror or a witness or, my God, there are thousands of people in Dallas, Texas who may stumble into one of those meetings. And the moment they stumble in those meetings and see my wife, they know she's not a drunk. I'm the only candidate, and I am tried and convicted of being an alcoholic, and I don't even know there's a trial going on. It's chaotic, and then what's going to happen is the word's going to get back downtown to my partners. And I know what they're going to do. I know because we already got a couple of alcoholics in my firm. That's what they say they are. They get drunk, don't show up at court. They go on trips, and we have to go find them, that kind of stuff, you know. And these guys are important people. I mean, they represent big clients. They got some stroke in the community, not like me. I'm just scuffing and scratching and trying to get there. They're already there. And we've been talking about what we're going to do with them. And what we're going to do with them, by consensus, is get rid of them just as soon as we can. Well, when they hear about me, I know what they're going to do. They're going to call me in, and I'm going to be gone that afternoon because I'm sure they're going to tell me we don't have any openings for alcoholic lawyers right now. It's all full. Now, I explained this to my wife. I explained it to her in the most simple, basic terms you can explain anything to anyone. I explained to her that I am the only one in this family who's working. I'm the only one who makes any money. We have a mortgage on it. If we don't pay the mortgage, they come and get the house, the cars, the furniture, whatever it is, they come and get it. They don't let you use it anymore when you're not paying for it. And when I stop earning money, they're going to come get all that stuff. We're going to be on the street. Me, my wife, and my two kids, in the cold, hungry, all because she persists in going to these damn meetings. And it's obvious to anyone that she's got to stop. Will you stop? And she said, I need to go. I said, please don't go to any more of those meetings. She said, I think I'm going. And then I abandoned reason and said, I'll kill you if you ever go again. She said, I'm going. If they get them for just a little while, let me tell you, they'll brainwash them to lay hanging there for damn near anything. It's scary. She kept going, and I couldn't leave it alone. I absolutely could not leave it alone. Every time I saw her, I thought about it. I picked fights by the thousands over that subject. I picked fights all kinds of ways. One night I decided I was going to pick a fight. Sometimes I kind of ooch up on them. I just kind of casually start the fight, you know, walk in and say, how's your day? Oh, good day. Kids okay? Yeah, kids are fine. What are we having for dinner? Oh, yeah, good. Looks good. I've been thinking. You think I am an alcoholic. Now, see, I need to establish this to win my argument later on. I'm just kind of going to ease in and get the facts I need to win my argument, and then we'll really go after it. But right now, I'm kind of playing along. you think I'm an alcoholic? And she says, I don't know whether you are or not. I said, well, that's damn funny. You've been calling me an alcoholic all these years. And she said, yes, but I was wrong. It's really very difficult to get a fight started when you're acting like that. She said, Jerry, it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't matter what I think. It matters only what you think. And I don't know whether you are or not. That's up for you to decide. If you decide you are and want some help, there's ways to get help. But until you make that decision, nothing that I say, your partner say, the doctor say, anybody says is going to make a nickel's worth of difference to you. Now, this really had me thrown off base. Here I am thinking I've got things going my way. I'm going to start a fight. I've got the first two answers I know. They come back to me the wrong answers. I've never heard of this kind of stuff before. And I make a mistake that no decent trial lawyer ever makes. I ask another question when I ain't got a goose's idea what the answer is. I say, well, if I wanted to find out if I was an alcoholic, how would I do it? Man, you talking about stepping off in the swamp. I was in there. She said, well, Jerry, they tell me that if you try some controlled drinking, if you would just drink two drinks every day for 6 months, no more, no less, if you can do that, you're probably not an alcoholic. I said, let me understand this. You've been trying to get me to stop drinking for years. Is it my understanding that you want me to continue drinking for 6 more months? She said, that's right. And I realized that I was dealing with a very sick woman. We weren't talking sense. Things were going not. I didn't understand what was happening, so I got the hell out of there. That's what I did. I just left. Got in my green chair in the den and began to drink my whiskey and think about this thing. And over the next couple of weeks, I realized that someone was going to have to make a sacrifice to save our family and me. And it was going to have to be me. I was going to have to pass that damn test to save our family and our home and do all that. She's too sick, obviously, to help us out here. Now, I didn't tell her that I was going to take the test. And actually, I had to make a few little changes in the test. Well, wait, you don't understand. Two drinks didn't do me any good, but three drinks would do. I had a pretty good sized glass, and I thought if I could have two big martinis before dinner and a big brandy after dinner, nobody could fault me for that, could they? Nobody would say anything about a man drinking that way, would they? Unless they were some kind of prohibitionist, which is what I secretly suspected all along. So I decided I would quietly take the test. I would just do it for a while. So she discovered, she watched like a hawk, and she'd see in maybe a month or 2 months at the outside that I was doing great. And she would come to me and say, I have made a mistake. I need to get out of Al-Anon. I need to let you get on with your life. And so I started trying to take the test. Here, I learned something. If you don't learn another thing from me tonight, if you're an alcoholic or think you might be in this room, learn this fact. Try controlled drinking. I would have a drink. The cares of the world would begin to slip off my shoulders and I'd get loosened up a little bit, you know. Then I'd have another drink. And then I would have a thought. And the thought would be something like, what are you doing? What are you doing? Are you over 21? Are you a man? Who supports all the damn people in this house? Are you going to let a bunch of little old ladies in tennis shoes tell you how to drink whiskey? And the answer was always, hell no. And I got up to the bar and drank what I wanted to drink. Generally the quart. Now, some days I went to the bar and I'd had a bad day. I just had a bad day. They'd been after me all day long. And I'd walk in and I'd walk up to the bar and I'd think about, okay, two martinis and one brandy. I'd say, to hell with it, I ain't going to take the tip. And I'd drink the bottle. Then I had another real key trick. I could go, say, for a couple of weeks and forget I was supposed to be taking the test at all. Now, when I remembered the test, when I forgot the test, or when I decided not to take the test, so the result was the same. I always drank about the bottle. Didn't get dog drunk every day, but I got pretty well along the way. And always, I woke up in the morning. I always remembered the damn test in the morning. My wife's sponsor was into this day at a time stuff, one day at a time stuff. She even tied it together with a little Bible quote. And she told my wife to say that out loud the moment she awakened in the morning. And it would go like, "This is the day the Lord has made. Rejoice." Now, if you haven't heard that quoted to you after you've had a quart of whiskey the night before, when your eyelids are stuck shut, your tongue's about that thick and got hair all over it, your heart's just going boom, boom, every beat of it you feel right up in your head, you know. When that's happened to you, you're pretty sure that you're not going to do a lot of rejoicing in that day. I came to know that in my mind, it had to do with those thoughts. I came to know that when I put alcohol in my system, it was like pouring gasoline on fire. There was no stopping it. It just accelerated. And then Billy began to quit covering up for me. She would answer the telephone, and when my clients called and I was drunk, she'd let me talk to them. It was, "Hello, Jerry." The next day they said, "What was wrong with you last night?" "I don't know. I had the flu, you know. Bad cold." Anyway, what happened to me ultimately, you know, I took that test. Well, I gave it a fair run. I didn't want to, you know, unless it was fully tested, I didn't want to accept the results. I ran it a year and a half. Never passed her once. At the end of that year and a half, all I could think about most of my day was alcohol. Wish I had a drink. Wish I hadn't had a drink. Wish I'd never heard of the damn test. What's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? It is illogical for a person who's disciplined himself the way I had in life to do the kind of things I needed to do, to be unable to decide, "I'm going to have three drinks today. That's all I'm going to have, just three drinks." Why can't you do that? Something is wrong with you. I must be some kind of a moral leper. Something's wrong with me. And my self-esteem, my self-confidence was beaten completely to the ground. And it'll always be that way with me anytime I undertake to do anything on a daily basis that I'm powerless to do. Just try going out and high jumping every day 8 feet. Convincing yourself today I'm going to jump 8 feet. Go up there and run, jump as high as you can. You can't do it. You keep doing it every day. Because it's frustrating. It's frustrating. Now, Billy never knew I was trying to take the test. No one in the world knew I was trying to take that test. But I knew. I knew, and I came to know, that I didn't have alcohol. Alcohol had me. I was powerless over alcohol. And finally, on January the 1st of 1973, having passed out at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on New Year's Eve, I was going to bring it in just right. No, I was this time. I'd messed up a couple times in the month of December. There was something about, we had a Sunday school group over. And I decided I'd serve brandy. Well, I'd had four martinis before the brandy came to mind. And I got the brandy snifter out and I got little glasses and nobody drank brandy with me at the Sunday school party. But I had one and I had a bottle hidden in the back of the house and I would go back and sweeten it up and I tried to make it look like I was just having one brandy. Of course, I drank a bottle of brandy during the course of the evening, and I'm told that I sang some Christmas carols that I learned when I was in the Navy.
You know, cute things like that. No sense of humor anywhere around. And I needed to bring in this day correctly, and I really planned we were going to go out to dinner, and I remember waking up in my chair and looked out the window, it was dark, and I saw Billy, and she was sitting in her chair reading or writing in a damn book like she was doing all the time. You know, she had one of the little pieces of literature, and she was always writing and reading that stuff. And I said, shouldn't we be getting dressed to go out? And she said, oh, Jerry, don't you know what time it is? And I looked at my watch, and it was 10 o'clock at night. I didn't have anybody to blame for that. I was sick of me. I was as sick of me as I've ever been. I was sick of what I was and what I couldn't be. I had no hope. And I walked to the bar and poured me a strong shot and drank it and went to bed. God willing, that's the last drink I'll ever have. I got up the next morning to a world without hope. And in desperation, I walked in the kitchen and told Billy that I was going to try to quit drinking. And she said, would you like for me to call someone from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, hell no. She said, here's a copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous and a little 24-hour day book. You might find them here. I took them and threw them against the wall, fairly close to where she was standing. And I said to her, I said, let me tell you something, lady. I don't know whether I can do this or not. I don't really know whether I can do this at all or not. But you keep them damn kids and the AAs and yourself and everybody else the hell out of my way, because it ain't going to be easy. And if anybody's going to do it, I'm going to do it. She said, you got it. And I sure did. I started trying to not drink. And I shook, and I, you know what happened to me. I came apart. I walked the streets of Dallas, and I looked at people, and they were laughing and functioning and doing well. And I'm walking around going crazy, wondering what the hell's wrong with me. Why can't I quit thinking about drinking? What's wrong with me? I was the loneliest person I've ever been. And in about 2 days, I decided that I would sneak in the house and read a little of that damn day literature. Now, I'm sorry I didn't read conference-approved literature, but I didn't have time. She was just going to be out. She was just going to be out of the kitchen for a minute. I knew she'd leave those books in there, so I sneaked in and I grabbed the little 24-hour day book. Opened it up, see what was inside it. Inside it was dates on the top of every page. And with that keen, incisive, alcoholic mind, I quickly looked at January the 2nd, right? To read what was on the page. And it described me perfectly. It said alcohol was messing up my life. It was the pits. I was disappointed with myself. And it said, this year we're going to give our drinking problem to God. I cannot tell you how disappointed I was when I read those words. How are you going to give something to someone you cannot find? I've been looking for God ever since I was a little old bitty kid. I went from the back of the church, I kept moving down closer to the front. When I had the altar call, you know, waiting for it to happen. Something spectacular is going to happen. I'm going to hear music. Big boys are going to talk to me from the clouds. I'm going to walk on some water. Something is going to prove to me that it's there, and then I'm going to believe in it. And I'm not going to ask the rest of these damn Christians. I'm going to, when I believe in it, I'm going to do what it says. If it'll just show me it's there. Never happened. Finally went to the front. My mother came up, and she was crying. Dad was patting me on the shoulder. They said, oh, Jerry, we're so happy for you. Neighbor people came around and said, don't you feel different? You know what I told them, don't you? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I feel a lot different. I did. I was more disappointed than ever been in my life because nothing happened to me. And it never, I couldn't make it happen. I looked in synagogues and cathedrals and every religion I could find. I read books. I studied. I was a spiritual mongrel. I couldn't find a home. Every time I think I just about had something going, they'd tell me something about what I had to believe. And I tried to believe. Did you ever try to believe something when you don't believe it? Sit down in a chair and just decide I'm going to believe it. I believe it. Don't believe it. Don't believe it. Have faith, they said, and then you'll believe. Okay, I'll have some faith.
Don't have any faith. Sit down in a chair and have faith. Okay, here we go. Have faith. Anything happen? Not a thing. Couldn't have faith and couldn't have belief because I didn't have experience that led me to that. So you can see why I was so disappointed on January 2nd. But I decided I ain't got anything else to try. And I tossed the little book out in the middle of the table and said, God, if you're there, I'm going to give you this drinking problem. And if you take it, I may do some more business with you. Best prayer I ever said. Dead honest. Deep need. Next day I knew something. I knew I wasn't going to be able to do it by myself. I knew I was going to have some help. And I needed some help with skin on it. Like people. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous, the only place I knew to call. And I began to talk to them. I didn't do what they told me to, by the way, because it didn't seem necessary. They had a lot of crazy ideas, like going to meetings every day. You know, I was too busy to do that. And they said, well, what do you do every night? I said, well, I've been drinking. They said, well, you've got to stop doing that so you're going to have a lot of time, aren't you? And I just didn't understand. But pretty soon I ran across a guy in AA. And the first ones I ran across had 12, 15, 20 years of experience. I look at him, I think, you know, you never had much of a problem. You couldn't have had much of a problem and stayed sober as long as you had. But then I ran across an old boy who had about 6 months, right out of the treatment center. I had literature sticking out of every pocket. looked and acted just like a drunk. I mean, he still had the yippies, you know, where you look real quick. And I followed him out of the meeting. And I said, what are you going to do about this? What do you think about this AA thing? We've been to a little home meeting. I was very anonymous. I couldn't go to regular AA meetings. I had to go to a quiet little home meeting. And he just passed through there one time. And I guess God sent him to get me. I don't know. But he said, you mean this little deal we've been here? I said, that's not AA. Oh, I said it is too for those people. But said, you know, that's not what we need. He said, we're going to have to change the way we think. We're going to have to take a lot of action. We're going to have to do the things they tell us to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you do what we tell you to do, we'll tell you what the result's going to be. We'll tell you what will happen. Now, that's proof. That's proof. If I tell you, if you step off the second story of this building, second floor, a power greater than yourself will take you immediately to the ground. That proves gravity. You can't see gravity, can you? You can't smell it, taste it. It's just there. But every time you step off the second floor of this building, the result will inevitably be the same. That's what they're telling you in Alcoholics Anonymous. You take the action to set out on those steps, and the result will always be a better life for you. If you take this action and do these things, you will have an experience with a power greater than yourself. It won't be anybody else's experience. It will be your own. You will have beliefs of your very own. You will have faith of your very own, based in your own experience. And so, I don't know exactly when or how or where I tried it. I did things that made no sense. I did things like look for self-centeredness and selfishness. I remember the first time I read those terms in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, I skipped the rest of the page. Because I was neither selfish nor self-centered. I knew that. I gave money to churches. I did all kinds of stuff. I couldn't be selfish and self-centered. Later on, I was in a meeting one night, and they were having a discussion. And I remembered something. When I was running the test, I got tired of television. If you ever get tired of television, I spent endless hours looking at the tube vacantly, whiskey and watching whatever was there. And I got tired of that, and one day I was in a pet shop, and I saw an aquarium. I decided I would buy me an aquarium. I was going to get the size aquarium that I wanted, and I did. I put it between my chair and the wall. It was my aquarium. I put gravel on the bottom of it, the color of gravel that I wanted, and I put pretty lacy, fern-like plants in it. And I put the kind of fish I wanted in it. I wanted pretty, slow-swimming fish. and I put a light on the top of it. And the light I put on the top of it so I could make it daylight or I could make it dark. And I fed my fish, if my fish were to be fed. Sometime it was a land of plenty, and sometime there was a fowl sitting in his mead one night remembering about the fish. And at this point in my AA career, I was thinking in terms of, you know, unmanageability really wasn't applicable to me, because I'd managed very well, except for a little problem with alcohol. And self-centeredness certainly wasn't anything that I had a problem with. And why should I read and study that? Why should I study about your problems? It didn't make any sense. And this night, though, I remembered that there was always one bad fish. Always a fish who would go along in the middle of my reverie, you know, when I was looking at the pretty fish, and begin to nip one of them on the tail, generally the prettiest one. And as he nipped him on the tail, he'd try to swim away from him, and he would swim faster. And he'd pass other fish, and they'd begin to swim faster, and they'd meet each other, and the first thing you know, the whole bowl was just going back and forth, and it just driving me crazy. And I'd reach over there and I'd slap the side of that barrel and go like that. Let them know there's a power greater than they are that is unhappy. And I was fair. I was fair. I gave them three chances. Now, you'd think they'd learn in three times, wouldn't you? Well, some of them don't. And I realized that there were some fish that needed a hands-on experience with the power. So I bought me a little net. And after I'd warned them three times with claps of thunder, I would reach down there and I would catch the bad fish. And I'd put my hand over the top of that dip net and I'd hold him on my lap. And I'd have a drink. I'd think about those people in the world out there that I'd like to get my dip net on. And I'd let him get still. Real still. And then I'd put him back. If you ever do this, I want to tell you something. If they float, it's all over. In three dip net treatments, too. Now, three claps of thunder, three hands-on experiences with the power. You'd know they're going to get it, wouldn't you? Well, there are such unfortunates, they seem to have been born that way. And I would dip them out the fourth time and look neither left nor right, go directly to the commode and flush them. Buy me another fish. And as I sat there in that meeting that night and remembered that, I thought, you know, I really can't even manage a fishbowl. So maybe my life isn't altogether manageable. And it occurred to me also that, you know, there are not too many men my age that much worry about how fish are behaving and take it personally. Maybe I am a little self-centered. Maybe I do take things a little too personally. Kind of broke through, you see. I experienced this program from the inside. Something was going on in that meeting that night that led me to see in myself exactly what I needed to see. And I began to inventory myself and to become aware of what it was that had been bothering me, that had given me all the trouble all those years, that had made me angry, that made me fearful, all those things. And you know what it turned out to be? It turned out to be thoughts. Thoughts. One kind was called a resentment, which is nothing more than a memory of something that's happened long ago. That it's all we're done with, but I can dredge it up. Judge it again, and it's bad. It didn't happen right. They did it to me. And my gut feels like it's happening to me right now. And I need relief when I feel that. Fear something's going to happen. Next Thursday is a bad day. I've got a lot of problems coming up on next Thursday. If I don't have anything to get through next Thursday, I may not be able to get through next Thursday. And when I get Thursdays, be next Wednesday following. You know, it's always moving just a little bit ahead of me. I can take a hangnail, look at it and say, you know, that might be cancer. It's red. I can't remember how long it's been there, but they say it doesn't heal, you know. And I've worn around the damn thing, and first thing you know, I'm in a doctor's office. Look at it. Have you ever seen one like that? It's fear. It's fear. It's a thought about what's going to happen. Guilt. That's where I didn't do so well. Envy, greed, all of them are thoughts. And they dominated my life. They colored everything I did. And I had to find out that was going on before, and I had to tell somebody, before I had a chance of setting them aside and developing new thoughts. And the new thoughts that I was given to think about were not about me anymore. I was given thoughts to think about, how can I stop doing these things? How can I stop thinking about these things so that I may be of maximum service to God and my fellow men? What I want to do is not take care of me anymore. I need to take care of God's business. I don't know what that is, but whatever it is for me to do, I need to do it. And the steps march me right along with what I believe is God's will in my life. They say, look around you, see what harm you've caused. Make a list of people you've harmed. So I made my list. And the rest of the program is directed away from me. I'm out trying to help my fellow man. If I am successful in this program, if I do it right, I believe I am changed, reborn, if you will, the way it's described in our book, from a person who is leading a life that is centered in self to one that is centered in service to my fellow man. Dr. Bob said, Alcoholics Anonymous can be summarized in two words, love and service. Love and service. And you get to doing that, and remarkable things happen in your life. I remember one night I was driving home from a meeting, going down a freeway, and I was singing a song. And I suddenly realized, you're singing a song. I hadn't sung a song in I don't know how long. And I looked around to see if anybody was watching me sing that song. And then I didn't give a damn. I just sang a couple more verses. One night I realized, going to a meeting, you don't need to go to a meeting. You don't have to go to a meeting. You're not going to get drunk today. You haven't thought about taking a drink for a while. Why are you going to a meeting? I want to go to a meeting. I like going to a meeting. I want to find out what happened to Bill. Did he get a new job? Did Sarah get her kids back? Did Lucy and Sam patch up their marriage? Did the new guy who took a chip last night, did he come back tonight? Can we call him and go get him? Heard about a drunk somewhere else. We can go get that one, couldn't we? Something's going to be happening at Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, and I want to be there. Because I don't want to miss it. Did you ever go to a meeting and somebody said, you weren't here last night? You really missed it. You say, what did I miss? I don't know, but you missed it. That's one of Jim Williams. And it's true. Whatever it was, whatever I was supposed to hear, I didn't hear it because I wasn't there. And I realized that I was in the middle of something, that people were getting well. Miracles were happening right in front of me. People who could not possibly make it were making it. I knew they weren't going to make it when they came in, or I'd have taken a picture of it. So it happened before and after. Now they're too much gone. You know, some just can't make it back. And damn, 2 weeks later, 2 months later, they're cleaned up. They got a job. They got families. They're making complete sentences. It's remarkable. It's just remarkable. And I'm a part of it. One of them said to me one night, you helped save my life. You know, I said, I'm a fisherman, Bob. That's when you set that hook. I don't ever have to worry about what's my purpose in life anymore. I know my purpose in life. I don't have any big long-term range, but I know one thing. I can work with drugs. I've got something that doctors of medicine, psychiatrists, psychologists, ministers would give a lot for, and that's the ability to reach an alcoholic who's still suffering. Now, I can't get them all. I need your help, too. You can get to some that I can't get to. Some will identify with your story and some with mine. So we're needed. And it's good for me and you both to know when we sat shoulder to shoulder in one of those meetings that we're needed. We are doing something together. We is better than me. And we have a common purpose and a common solution, and we're on the high road. And our life is of meaning. It's meaningful. I haven't worried about having a purpose in life for a long time. It's just the hole's been filled. I just feel good about my life anymore. I still work. I've got the same wife and kids. My son's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, 8 years of sobriety now. I was able to let up on him long enough for him to see the solution. And when he had the problem, he was able to come to me and his mother and say, I got a problem with you. And that was a great gift, just to see him pick that up and go on with it. My life's better in every area that it's ever been. I have a good spiritual life today. Some days better than others, but I have a good spiritual life. I used to wonder what it was going to be like when I found God. What's it going to be like? Big voice? Bush going to talk to me? Walk on water? I got to confess to you that I can walk a little bit, but if it gets over ankle deep, I'm in a lot of trouble. I'm fallible. I have all my humanness. But I have experienced the peace that it talks about in the promises. I have experienced the turning of my dark past into an asset that it talks about in our book. I have ease and comfort today. I have serenity. I have joy. I believe that's what it is like to experience the power. If it's any better than that, I don't know about it yet. But boy, I'll tell you, that beat anything I ever had before. It's so strong and so sweet. And sometimes in a meeting, when it's quiet, and you're identifying, and you can just feel it, there's something there. There's an electricity in the air that it just cuts through everything else in your life. All the problems you had are just gone. And you know, this is it. I pray that's happening to you as you go to your meetings and go back to your groups and carry this message. This program we have goes across the world. It represents, in my opinion, the greatest opportunity this world has for a solution, salvation, if you will. Not salvation in the biblical drum-beating sense, but that kind also. This is the opportunity for peace. This is the opportunity for men and women of all walks, all races, all colors, all creeds, all nationalities to form a common bond, one with the other, to reach down and help the person who is less fortunate than we are. Addiction of all forms today is helping this power. Maybe that's the purpose of addiction, to get people in the right frame of mind so they can be helped. But the plan needs people to reach down and help them, to become the lessons for the others, so that they can follow in the footsteps of those who have recovered. That may be the master plan. I like to think it is. I believe if there's ever going to be peace in this world, it'll be because all men are peaceful. It won't be because governments get together and legislate. It'll be because we decide we don't want to fight each other, don't want to hurt each other. We want to be kind and loving to one another. I think that's the way we're spreading this. This program today is in Russia. This program today is behind the communist bloc in a lot of areas. Poland and other places have Alcoholics Anonymous going today. And it's growing, as long with addiction and this sort of thing. Addiction and alcoholism and all of those things are running rampant in my country, and I think they are in yours. And if anybody's going to be there for the guy, thank God for somebody there for me. I'm glad Bill and Bob didn't just get sober and hang her up, because I needed some help when we got there. And those early members of Alcoholics Anonymous kept the faith. They went along day after day keeping the faith. And they've done a lot for you and me. We wouldn't be anywhere today unless we had them. But we won't be anywhere tomorrow unless we fulfill our legacy of passing it on to the alcoholic who still suffers. I hope next year you can uphold all the people. You can't get everybody in this room that comes to this conference. I hope you're forced to go to the whatever kind of town hall you've got, or some bigger place, or have it on a hill. I hope everybody here has got a pigeon next year that just drives you crazy. Ask you all them dumb money, just does everything to you that you did to yours. Well, maybe not quite that bad. I won't wish that off on you, but just keeps you occupied and keeps you passing on. It's a great life we've been given, not one we deserved. It's a marvelous miracle called Alcoholics Anonymous. This meeting tonight is a perfect proof of the miracle to my way of thinking. Let's just stop for a minute and think about the people we know in this room. Do you suppose there's anybody in here who's ever violated a law? Anybody in here who's ever stiffed a creditor? Failed to pay child support? God, we've done everything that's been done in here, haven't we? Now, what would it be like if we came to the mayor of this fair city and said, look, there's a group of us. We've done a lot of things. We've broken every law there is to break. We owe a lot of people money. We're really pretty much antisocial people. We'd like to get together in one of your major hotels here and have a little conference. Here we are. God's kids, doing what we think is His will as best we can. And look how far it's carried us. No perfection here, just progress, just good spirit, just unconditional love. You know, a lot of people are talking today about who ought to be allowed to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't see anywhere in our traditions where it gives anybody the right to judge that. I think that's an inside job. I think if I say I have a desire to stop drinking, I'm in. And I don't think you got any right to run me out. I think you better worry about why you're at the damn meeting and not why I'm at the damn meeting. Let's don't become AA lawyers. God knows there are enough lawyers in the world. Let's just give it away. Let's just give it away and continue to do one day at a time what we've been given to do, which is carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the message is, God's done for me what I couldn't do for myself. Thank you so much.